Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Theater Podcast, intimate personal conversations with the industry's biggest names. This episode is with Drew Gasparini, who is a performer and singer and songwriter that you may have never actually heard of by name, but you probably know his work. One of the most favorite things of his that he's done recently that I love is the 2019 PR stunt Skittles commercial, The Broadway Musical, starring Michael C. Hall. He wrote all the music for that. He's got some other adaptations he's working on, including the Broadway-bound Karate Kid. And this guy is insanely funny, insanely energetic, and just raw and honest. I recently met him digitally in real life because of COVID. We haven't met in person, but we've been working together on a couple things, and I just knew immediately I had to hear his full story and get him as a guest on this podcast. His story is so unique. And with all the projects he's working on right now, he's going to be a household name in a few years. So we are really lucky to get him now. I just have to give you a little warning, though. He's very raw, very unfiltered. So lots of strong language. But oh, it is so worth it. As always, find me online on Instagram and Twitter at theater_podcast, on the web at thetheaterpodcast.com. Please leave a rating, leave a review. I love to read the ratings. Now, everybody, please enjoy this episode with Drew Gasparini. Attention all theater lovers, this Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
I don't need an intro. Ladies and gentlemen, Joe Iconis.
Well, here's the intro I wrote for you. All right, so here, see if you like this one.
Yeah.
Today's guest is one of the most popular singer-songwriters that you've never heard of in the Broadway scene. He's currently writing the score for the Broadway-bound adaptation of The Karate Kid, adaptation of Night Shift for Warner Brothers Theater Ventures, another adaptation for Universal Theater Group, and like three or four more things that Wikipedia can also tell you about. He doesn't flush after he uses the toilet. He's Italian, but not from the sexy bloodline. He's from the hairy and balding Italian bloodline.
Yes.
He has a new dog that is part pterodactyl named Commissioner Gordon, shares a room with the Christmas decorations at his parents' house, and is not ashamed to admit he's riding his best friend Alex Brightman's coattails. He's not well known for writing the music for the 2019 PR stunt Skittles commercial, The Broadway Musical, and his new podcast, Now We're Talking, continues to make me rufflecopter. Drew Gasparini, welcome to the Theater Podcast.
Oh, wow. That is, I guess that'll do as an intro. I guess that'll work. That'll work just fine. Wow. Yeah. You listed, what does the Wikipedia look like these days? I haven't checked that out in a couple of years. Is it like?
I don't know. I was going to ask you if you wrote it because it's like way more successful than I had pegged you for.
Where did you peg me? Were you like, he does 54 Below shows often enough that I would think that's all he has going on, really?
No. So, I mean, knowing you, and I know I can give you a little bit of shit. I just want to throw out the strong language warning for everybody listening right now.
Yes,
anyway.
This one has an explicit warning for sure.
Yeah. No, like I know so many people here in New York through the Broadway scene, and mostly my connections are like the people on stage, and I've gotten to know the production team behind a lot of stuff. But then you're in that sweet spot of like the creative side that's not on stage, but you're not like the money, you're not driving the money behind shows. You're just creating great content, but you're not on camera, so people don't necessarily know your name. But in reading, researching you, you've done so much stuff. It's so cool.
I've done a few things, and it's all led me here to my parents' garage, kids. No, that's nice of you to say. I like where I sit in terms of that sweet spot. I always had, this is a very weird reference perhaps, but when I was a kid, I really wanted to be like Ben Harper famous. You know what I mean? Like, everyone knows Ben Harper's Steal My Kisses song, but like no one knows who Ben Harper really is. And like you wouldn't be able to pick him out on the street or something like that. You wouldn't be like, oh my God, that's Ben Harper. Because he's kind of like just, you know, only the diehards know. I wanted to be the kind of guy who had diehards who would really enjoy what he does, but everybody else is aware of the songs but have no idea who the songwriter is. That has kind of been my career. And beyond that, I get confused for other composers all the time and much more successful composers than I. So, you know, you take some, you win some, you lose some, I guess. It's all right.
Well, I don't know how actually, I didn't look on Wikipedia. I don't know how old you are, but you seem like a young guy. You're young in spirit. But
you can go with that. I actually am 71 years old.
Yeah. You look good. Look good
I
for
have
71.
Four grandchildren. Thank you.
That you don't know about.
It's because of the money. Alan, it's because money is the best lotion, and I've done so exceedingly well that I looked this good. No, I'm 34. I'm 34 years old. I'm right in that millennial, you know, whatever area.
But you've done so much, and there are some big credits, like writing the score for a musical that is most definitely Broadway bound, and you've got your own, I think, four albums, right? Like your own independent music. That you've written.
Yeah, I have no idea how many albums I have out, but yeah, so I don't even know what albums have been released. I know I've written probably and recorded 10, 12 albums, and maybe three or four have got released. I have no idea.
Well, so where does it, is this just one of those things where like you just keep going and you're just like dropping poop of creativity, this trail behind you, and then somebody happens to step in it and take it with them?
Yes, or, that's my hope, is that people step in heaping, steaming piles of my creativity and it lingers into their household. And then they look back and they see the trail, the footprints, and they go, ah, man, I stepped in Drew's creativity again. I just had another composer friend of mine on my podcast, Now We're Talking, with the same network that we're under the umbrella of here, Ryan Scott Oliver. He and I were both talking about, you know, craft and process and meow, 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 boring stuff, basically. Please tune in, kids. But it's...
my podcast is so boring. Please listen.
There's nothing of interest for everybody, but tune in if you like that. We were just talking about like being prolific, and there's two things to it. There's like being busy is kind of always a good thing for a creative-minded person. And the other side of it is you're always going to be an up-and-comer until you've up and came, basically. So I have signed 5 Broadway contracts, and I have never had a show on Broadway, not counting the Skittles musical, of course. That was kind of a fluke. But it's bananas to me that there is, people look at it and go, oh my God, you've done so much. And I happen to be a little bit known for the things that I've done, but I've never done the big one. And I think that being that close so many times just makes me hungrier and hungrier and hungrier to feed the monster, basically. And I can't stop myself. It's becoming, dating me is a nightmare. Dating me must be an absolute fucking nightmare, because I get so tunnel vision on, I want to say the career, but it's not necessarily the career. It's the legacy. It's the, I want to write something that's left behind in a big way. Like, I know that sounds a little selfish and ego-centered, but I guess that's kind of the nature of being a writer in the first place. I'm going to keep writing things until one of them really works in the mass public. And that's just going to be the game. So that's probably why it looks like I've done so much. I really want it so bad. I'm so hungry for show business to work in my favor. And it has in many, many respects. But again, I so badly want the big thing, man. I so badly want it.
Well, to quote Andre DeShields, the top of one mountain is the bottom of the next.
So beautifully said, yes.
So as soon as you get this big one, then, I mean, like Andrew Lloyd Webber didn't stop. Cameron McIntosh didn't stop.
Yeah.
With these people who just are known for writing hit after hit, I wonder if something like this, actually, though, now that I'm thinking about it, is it like Karate Kid's going to come to Broadway? That's going to be your big blowout thing. And all of a sudden, everything's going to be on the map and you'll get 5 million Tonys. And
yes.
Then everything that you've written in the past, people are going to go back and look at that and bring that up with it.
Well, I think that's kind of part of the hope, I would say. You know, to speak to the 5 million Tonys, yes, I will win 5 million Tonys. I really do think Karate Kid is going to be, it's going to change everyone's idea of what a Karate Kid musical would and should look like. I really think it's going to defy expectations, and I'm wildly excited for that project to make it all the way there. But there's this idea in show business that I've seen, and I'm not saying this is the rule, this is how it goes, but I have seen this. There's an idea of permission. And if Karate Kid is, because it is going to Broadway, that's not the question. This is the first time I've had a show like we're doing this. This is a huge title. People are excited about it. It's happening. Pressure on my shoulders, diarrhea every morning, things like that. But the show is going to go, if it is a success, my hope is that it offers me the permission to say, now that I am getting attention as the writer of this successful thing, I can say, now that you've trusted me to create a success, can we look at some of these things in my back catalog here and maybe bring them to the surface? Because now I have a little bit of a fan base, more people know who I am, and this show has been a success. In the same way, it's not just permission to do the old stuff, it's permission to do stuff I've always wanted to do. Writing a movie and creating a TV show or scoring an animated movie, these are things I want to do. And sure, you can take meetings for that, but we know how this business works. The door gets open and quickly shut, but the door stays open if you're like, by the way, 5 million Tonys. You know what I mean?
Right.
And then they'll be like, okay, what do you want to do next? And I'll say, I want to do this animated movie. And that's what I would like to do. Then the conversation becomes easier. So yes, it is. Every success is the new bottom of the mountain to get to the next one. I really do understand that philosophy, and I appreciate it a lot.
Well, so I want to get into how you got into Karate Kid, but before that, walk me back to your childhood, right? Because
sure.
you grew up in California, which is where you are now with the mm-hmm. Christmas ornaments.
Yep, that's where I live.
And so now you've got all this stuff under your belt, but I akin to my heart, you started an a cappella group in high school.
Yes.
But nerd. So before that, when did you start? I mean, where did music come into your life? What are your parents like? Were instruments
music
singing?
It was like water and food and oxygen. I mean, it was really just that accessible in my household. And it's before theater really was. It was always music. My dad is a very Led Zeppelin-induced rock drummer and taught me how to play drums when I was at a very young age. And I started playing in bands and exploring music in that way. My mom was a music teacher. And I think by virtue of my mom being a music teacher, I had interest in it, but I also had a vast non-interest in being taught. So I never wanted to take real lessons. I just wanted to play with the things that she made accessible in the house. So I would sit at the piano, and I have a musical ear that I think I got from my mom. I'd pick up a guitar, she'd show me a chord, and I'd take it from there. And there was just like hand drums and horns and whistles and all kinds of shaky. You couldn't fall down and not land on an instrument in my house growing up. And also we had like, my mom has great taste in music, thank God. So does my dad. From all those wonderful bands in the 70s like Led Zeppelin and The Who and the Pink Floyd and Grateful Dead and all those kinds of things, to the entire Motown catalog, to the greatest singer-songwriters of Joni and Elton and Billy Joel and that whole part of the record business was like really huge in our household. So songwriting and good songwriters was just around. And I started writing songs. I always wanted to be an actor, always, until I was about I don't know, 14. But I started writing songs when I was like 12. And the first song I ever wrote, I thought was a masterpiece. And it was kind of, which it wasn't, but I thought it was because I wrote a song. And I think that's all it took. It was like, wow, I did this. This is the best thing that's happened to music. I had an unhealthy ego, I think, too. but it was a song about how it was a Mother's Day gift for my mom. And I've talked about this in other interviews before, but I love telling this story because it makes me really want to dig up this song and like kind of chisel away to find whatever gems might exist in this old, old, old original song of mine. But it was about me karate chopping my way out of my mom's womb.
that's a horrible image.
It was kind of this like, I'm going to escape this womb. And I did so by like blasting forth and here I am. And, you know, it was that. And, I think just the reaction that that song got from my family, who are the only people I played that song for ever, was like enough for me to be like, maybe I should try writing another one. And then maybe I should try writing another one. And everybody was so thrilled with the fact that I was young and writing, they made it seem like, wow, great. Wow, you did that. And I took that as I'm so good at this until high school, when I played a few of my songs for my music teacher, Emily Gates, who is the world's biggest badass in the entire world. I love her. I still thank her at shows, even when she doesn't show up to them. I'm like, I just want to thank Emily Gates for no reason at all. She's just wonderful. But I played her like three of what I considered my best songs at the time. And she was like, oh, okay, so that's it. That's, wow, you got some work to do. And I was like, oh my God. And if she hadn't done that, I don't think I would have actually continued to pursue songwriting. She challenged me and she made me realize, oh, I just think I'm good. I have to actually work at being good. And it was that little bit of criticism or it wasn't necessarily criticism. It was just non-excitement about the songs. It shook me in such a way that I was like, I better get my shit together and dedicate my life to this. I took it so seriously. And at the age of 14 or whatever that was, I really treated it like a job. I avoided doing all my homework and studying for all my tests. And I was a miserable high school student, but I got good at writing songs in high school because I dedicated all that time to writing songs because this woman was like, you're not good yet.
So that's either, I think, indicative of a really insecure personality or a really egotistical personality. There's nothing in the middle.
I agree. And I think it was kind of equal parts both. I think I was insecure without realizing it until it was pointed out to me. And other than that, I think I just had this like, you know, typical high school white straight male confidence. I'm just like, I'm untouchable, world. It's a horrible thing to look back and acknowledge that now. But I do think that, I don't think I was cocky. I was just really confident because I was a theater kid at heart. So of course I was insecure.
So high school, you've got your quartet, your a cappella quartet.
Yep.
And I guess you were at some point deciding to go to college for this.
Yeah, a little bit. I begrudgingly decided that college is decided. I begrudgingly said yes to my mom when she said you have to go to college or it's not really an option. Like even if it's a community college or what, I didn't want to do any of that. I was so not interested. Even throughout high school, I was negotiating with my teachers. How can I pass this class? We both know I'm not going to do the work. We both know algebra. Algebra is not where I excel. And this is what I mean about the stupid confidence. I think I was just confident in my ability to talk and you charm a little bit. So I really would try to charm my teachers into believing that I was above algebra, that I, out of all these students, I brought it to their attention that I am not suited for this. Let's both agree. And they would say, okay, let's put it this way. Drew, if you write a new song every Friday and showcase it to the class and really put the work in that I can see for myself, I will help curb your grade. I had teachers that did that for me.
Like for algebra, you were writing songs to pass. You were writing musical songs to pass algebra.
Yeah, I would do like the bare minimum amount of homework just to scrape by. And like I would do pretty miserably on the tests, but the way she would curve my grade, I'm going to be hated by everybody after telling this story. But the way she would curve the grade was, we struck a deal, you know, like you put in the work. If you show me that songwriting is a real job, because people don't believe it is still to this day, hashtag the government, hashtag taxes. I can prove to her that I'm willing to sacrifice things to take this pursuit of mine very seriously. So I actually think that's a really good teacher, by someone finding the individual in the student and saying, listen, you have to do some of the work, but I also want to help you get out of here because I want you to pursue your dream as well. So that's what I got out of that. And so the college thing, I went to a community college for a half a second, and that half a second is forgotten completely because of all of the weed I smoked during that half a second. I lived on the beach in Santa Barbara. I was majoring in, get ready for this, jazz appreciation. What the fuck do you do with a degree in jazz appreciation? This is a perfect example of how we're all getting fucked, kids. We're all getting fucked by our college degrees. There's a degree that exists in a major for jazz appreciation. Anyway, so left that school, went to a music conservatory-ish program. It's more of a trade school for musicians called the Musicians Institute. It's on Hollywood Boulevard in the thick of tourism in Los Angeles. And I went there and I went to classes for about 5 weeks until I decided I was kind of taking steps backwards. I mean, we were looking at the circle of fifths and we were like, you know that every good boy does fine. I'm like, this is what we learned in middle school, elementary school. This is so weird to be taking this many steps back. So I dropped out, didn't tell my parents that I dropped out. I had them convinced I was going to the school for 3 years.
You charm. 3 years.
Well, 2.5 years to get the degree I was going for.
Oh my goodness.
And instead I just played shows everywhere. I played shows all over the West Coast. I had a band called Drew G and the B, which stood for Drew Gasparini and the band. And we played coffee shops and bars, and I wasn't old enough to be in most of these places, but we played everywhere we could. We got the chance to share the stage with Jason Mraz and the Plain White Tees and Third Eye Blind, and it was a lot of fun, and it opened up different doors. It got me a development deal with Sony for a quick amount of time. It didn't pan out into a record deal, but I was being looked at, and now, you know, when you see little bits like that come together, you start looking back at that high school time and going, I'm showing that teacher that I'm putting in the work. Yeah. I'm doing it. I don't need to get a degree that says, look, I'm a musician. I'm showing everybody how dedicated I am. I'm sleeping in my car. I'm driving from gig to gig. I am broke. And then all of a sudden I have money. And then I'm broke again. And then all of a sudden, you know, you get used to that artist lifestyle and you go, I'm doing it. I'm fucking doing it. So that was a really exciting part about college, was dropping out and then actually getting an education in the quote unquote real world of music.
Did you have a big coming out moment to your parents where you're like, Mom and Dad, I'm not a college graduate?
So yeah, I did it when I booked Smash in 2012, there were interviews for Playbill and all sorts of things with all the new writers of season 2 of Smash. And it was like me and Pasek and Paul and Joe Iconis and Andrew McMahon, who was like a hero of mine. That was so cool. But I remember answering some questions and then outing like, oh yeah, I dropped out of college. And that's how my parents learned. So I would have graduated in 2007. They thought I did graduate. I played up some whole thing of like, don't come down to the school for graduation. The ceremony is going to be lame. My brother, who lived in Long Beach at the time, came and took pictures of me holding a fake degree in front of the campus of the school. So my parents thought like any day now, this degree will be mailed to the house and we can put it up next to his brother's and, you know, this, that, and the other. So it was 5 years later that they read it in an interview on Playbill or something, that they were like, wait, what? And that was a huge trust issue with me and my parents, but I think we've all moved past it and they understand why I did it.
Well, when, by the way, I want to go back a second. So I need you to write me a song that's called A squared plus B squared equals C squared, so we can splice that in when you're talking about the songs you would perform in algebra.
Sure. I love that. Here we go, kids. Doing, 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 tuning the guitar. And then it's this old favorite, Pythagorean theorem or whatever. Pythagorean theorem. I can't even fucking say it. I love that. Oh my God. Yeah.
Okay. So now you're back here. So immediately you just jumped into Sony and then you got hired on Smash, but at some point you're living the artist lifestyle, you're living out of your car, and then you're and at what point are you, do you connect into the musical theater world? Because the artist lifestyle, the Mraz, the everybody else that you were talking about, nowhere near musical theater.
Nowhere near musical theater. And like I said, I always wanted to be an actor, and I had done theater basically all through middle school and high school. And I think some of that confidence and young ego came from, I was that kid who got, if it was Music Man that year, I was Harold Hill. If it was, you know, whatever, if it was Guys and Dolls, I was Sky Masterson or whatever. It was like, that's just how it was based on who the talent was and the situation. It's community theater. I mean, like, that's just what the fuck it was. So I always had an idea of musicals. I always loved musicals. I'd never really been to New York or seen a real Broadway show. All of my experience in musical theater was community theater. But I had a grasp of the storytelling. In fact, when I was writing as a singer-songwriter, some of the notes I would get, some of the reviews I got in my albums would be like, he's very wordy, he's very theatrical in his storytelling, and which is so funny because when I started writing for musical theater, everybody was like, he's too pop-oriented. So I couldn't find a world I really lived in as a songwriter for a minute. But I just stopped playing gigs for like 2 months. I just was like, okay, this is tiresome. I literally am in my car most days and most nights, and I'm getting paid such peanuts for these shows. And I just needed something to kind of stimulate me again. And I got a piano. My roommate and I at the time, we bought a piano together, and then he left. He had to go to England because that's where he's from, and in London. So he had to go back for some family stuff. And while he was gone, I just figured some shit out on the piano and wrote a musical. And I to this day, it's like I blacked out and I woke up and I had a musical written, and it was called Crazy Just Like Me. I made up the story as I went. There was no, I had no idea how to storyboard. I didn't know how to do any of this. It was a very, a learn by doing experience. And I was just so, it was just like writing my first song. I was so pleased that I did it that I was like, this must be amazing. Let me show this to everybody. And one of my friends who I did theater with growing up was a writer in New York named Kirsten Gunther. And she was actually Ryan Scott Oliver's writing partner. She wrote Benny and June, and she's, she does her theater thing in New York. Mm-hmm. And she said, you should send this to NIMF, the New York Musical Theater Festival.
Yeah.
And this is 2006, I think. And I sent them a copy of the show, and they wrote a handwritten letter back. And I say this in a lot of interviews, but I love this story because it's important to showcase to kids or anybody who wants to be doing something like this. The answer that you don't want is no, but that's also the only bad answer you can get. So it's not all that bad. Just pursue, pursue, pursue. So I pursued. I submitted this to NIMF. They wrote a handwritten letter back, which I took very personally because who the fuck does that? Even back then, it would have been an email, I feel like.
Right, right.
And they said, your musical stinks, but your songs are like exactly what Broadway is gearing toward. And like, this is in the era of like, everybody's trying so hard to sound like Edges or Jason Robert Brown or any of that. And I was putting my own little weird spin on whatever that sound was. And I took it seriously. They said, we want you to come to New York. We would recommend that you try living in New York and meet some people and try your hand at this business. So very shortly after, without knowing anything about New York, I moved to New York. And it was a very impulsive move, but it started opening doors, I want to say right away, because it did feel that way. The first couple of years in New York moved so fast. But it was a couple of years of like, cold emailing people. I just saw their name in a playbill. Titus Burgess. Who the fuck is that? And I look up who he is. I'm like, oh my God, he's tremendous. So I'll go to the stage door of Little Mermaid and wait for Sebastian the Crab to come out, Titus Burgess. And I give him a demo and say, would you want to sing this? And then it was a bunch of no's in a row. And then he shot me a message on Facebook. He goes, hey, I just looked at some of your other stuff. I don't want to sing the stuff you're sending me, but I'd love to sing this song.
Ooh.
And I was like, wow, okay. So I got a show together. I had Titus Burgess in it, and I had an unknown Michael Kilgore. I had an unknown Jeremy Jordan at the time sing a handful of my songs. And the footage of that concert opened up every door it just started everything for me. And people started buying my sheet music, and people started hiring me for writing jobs. And I was like, oh, this is actually a career. And I cemented my feet in musical theater because in my eyes now, it's not pop versus musical theater. Musical theater is an all-encompassing genre. And I love that. And I love the collaborative spirit and removing your ego completely, which is something I wish I could have told young Drew. You will be more successful the minute you suck your ego out of the equation. And you're just there to play and you're just there to make a good end product because that's what everyone's trying to do. That was my emergence into the New York musical theater scene. It was kind of a gift.
This is a world that I have so little knowledge about. And usually when I hear about a production or if I'm involved with anything, it comes with the creative team already. Mm-hmm. So to hear this story, I mean, I've interviewed so few composers or songwriters on this podcast because
we're just a wacky bunch. I don't blame you. We are a handful.
Well, like Eddie Perfect for Beetlejuice, hearing his story just out of the blue, just shows up in New York, is like, oh, Alex Timbers is casting this thing. I'm gonna write a demo and send it over. And Alex decided to like the tenacity that you have to get your stuff heard in front of everyone else. I was at an event once. I was moderating an event with Jamie Foxx and someone from the audience came up to ask a question and was like, hey, I got this iPod Shuffle with my demo on it. Will you listen to it? Like right there in the middle of the room. Yeah. And Jamie's like, yeah, hand it over. And so in the green room afterwards, Jamie Foxx is with his team like, hey, this stuff's actually pretty good. Right?
No.
So just the huevos that this dude had in front of a room of strangers, in front of Jamie Foxx to hand his stuff. And like, you're talking about going off to Titus Burgess and...
It's not quite the same as Jamie Foxx, I would say. But yes, you know why I did that? I was reading about Pasek and Paul and they were like, yeah, we just like waited for Shoshana Bean at the stage door and just hounded her until she said yes. And I was like, I guess that's how you do this. And in many circumstances, having the cojones to do that is what's going to behoove you in this business and just get you seen and remembered and pushed down the line. The same thing. Did you see that clip of Maggie Rogers?
Mm-mm.
She plays her songs for Pharrell and Pharrell's like on the spot, like signs her like right there. And now she's fucking Maggie Rogers. It's like, it blows my mind. She was an NYU student. You know?
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. I had no idea. I mean, you hear about the overnight success stories. And so you could say like, you know, your overnight success is all of a sudden you've put on this concert and you've just got everybody beating down your door. But how many years of being what, as you describe it, somewhat homeless existed before this?
The whole thing about overnight success, everybody has to understand is that's just such a fallacy. I love that even Lizzo, she was like, everyone's calling me like an overnight success. I guess they didn't see the like 9 years of killing myself for this, trying to make it. It's insane. And even now, like whatever people chalk up as success, that's subjective. And anybody who looks at me as a successful artist, I appreciate that very much. But there is that Hamilton-minded, I will never be satisfied kind of thing. And I don't know if my standard for my personal success will ever be met. So I'm going to always just kind of shun the idea of overnight success. I'm just going to like treat it like you're a doctor or a lawyer or whatever. You're doing your job. You're doing it as best you can. And you might do very well one day. You might not, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, at least doctor or lawyer, like you come out of that with a lot of debt. But at least you're guaranteed a career. Artistry, being an artist, you come out with a lot of debt. And
so you understand my beef with college education in terms of the arts. I want BOCO and Carnegie Mellon and all these fuckers to listen up to me real loudly. Lower your tuition prices. That is obscene what you are charging for these kids to get into a profession where they're ultimately not going to be making the money to pay back these loans right away by any means, unless they're crazy lucky. You're going to be paying these student loans back till the end of fucking time. It's so not fair. And I do think if any theater students are listening, I don't want to diminish the experience or the opportunities you get in college because they're amazing and there are some amazing theater colleges out there. But some of the best education I've had is just failing in New York. And no matter what, you're going to graduate college, you're going to get to New York and be like, what? This is nothing like they taught us because that happens all the time. New York is going to be the pinnacle of education for you in terms of what it is you're trying to do in this industry. I will always stand by that claim.
Oh, I absolutely agree with that. I've heard that so many times, is people from all different walks of life, all different levels of education, all different colleges and regions around the world. Once they come to New York, full college education or not, Juilliard down to community college, mm-hmm. everyone gets here. And even the people who have success immediately straight out of college, if you're lucky enough to get that one show, then you're dry for years.
Yeah.
And you're like, and your ego just takes that much harder of a hit because you've been propped up the entire yep. time.
Yep.
And you get out into the, I put in air quotes, real world, right?
Yep.
And then all of a sudden, you're not the star of the show anymore. You're not the center of attention anymore.
That can be soul damaging. Absolutely.
Yeah. And without the resiliency internally, the resolve to continue to fight, and I guess either the extreme insecurity or the extreme egotisticality, is that a word?
That's
extreme,
a word now. Extreme, yeah, sure.
Okay, we'll go with that. Egotisticality. Supercalifragilistic.
Yeah.
Then egotisticality to espialidocious. Then yeah, you just give up. And I can see why there are so many people in this industry that are just prone to the anxiety and the depression and the yes. downward spiral of working to live versus living to work.
100%. 100%. I just said, God, I wish that his episode was coming out any sooner, but I just recorded an episode with Rob McClure, who I think is like
the nicest guy.
But when it comes to how he approaches his work and this business, he is the mouth of reason. Everything he says is about the work and loving the work, and don't worry about those down moments and don't quit. Like, if you really love it, everybody, you're going to have down moments. Stick with this shit. People quit so quickly because they leave college. They were top dog at their college. They get, maybe they book a Broadway show right out of college, but then they have those 2-3 dry years afterwards. They're going to quit the fucking business.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
it's given up on themselves. And it's like, then maybe you didn't love this thing as much as the rest of us love this thing. And maybe you shouldn't be here with us. You should fucking love this thing. You know, I take that shit so seriously. I'm sure a lot of people will disagree with my opinion on this, but man, if you don't love it, get out of it. You know, go find something else if you don't love this.
Well, yeah, that's what people say all the time, is that if you can see yourself doing anything else, do that thing.
Yeah,
because
sure.
this is something where you have to do it because it is who you are.
But also on that respect, like, it doesn't mean like if you have to wait tables for a couple of years that you're a failure. It means that you're an artist, and that's the nature of the game. You know what I mean? People wait tables for 2 years like, I guess I'm just going to have to go back to school. It's like, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? You're making your rent. You're paying your bills. You're still auditioning. Make sure you can make this business work for you. And that all depends on your approach to it.
Well, now, especially with the internet and technology, and even after 2020 being the shit year that it was, teaching mm-hmm. us that we can do almost as much as we were doing in person remotely, aside from physically go and see theater.
You know, plotting in a room together, we can't do that. But.
Yeah, you know, but you can get into commercial auditions and do voiceovers from your yes. home and do book reads. And like you were saying, pick up an instrument. I interviewed somebody who was just like, I'm bored in quarantine. And now she's giving virtual Zoom concerts after learning the guitar for like 5 or 6 months ago.
There you go. And I honest to God, you start a podcast.
We're going to take a short break. Stay tuned for more of the episode.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUPS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUPS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that With brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Actually, okay, good segue. Now we're talking with Drew Gasparini. That's your podcast.
That's my
Tell
podcast.
Tell me why, with everything you have going on, you've got all the shit. You've got Wikipedia touting your accolades, and it's on the internet, so it's got to be
Wikipedia.
True.
Yep, must be.
Must be. Why start a podcast in the midst of everything else, and what are you aiming to get across with your shtick?
Well, it's. I think what I'm trying to get across is what's interesting about artists is the human side, and what fans really cling to is the artist side, because it's like the way that fans look at theater workers or actors and composers and directors that they love, they put them so high on this pedestal. So the idea of this podcast was really, let's ask really dumb questions that humanize these people a little bit. Sure, we talk about process and sure, we talk about their career a little bit, but I really wanted a format where it wasn't about Broadway necessarily. It was just kind of about like, how weird were you in middle school? Like, let's talk about like the most embarrassing shit that happened to us when we were kids and how it traumatized us and made us the whack jobs that we are today. And the reason I chose to do it was certainly not for a lack of things to do. Things did slow down during COVID, but I think more for the performers, it really did. But we were still being asked to write and meet deadlines, and Karate Kid has not slowed down at all. So I've definitely been working on all these other projects. I wanted to take it upon myself to make an effort to showcase this human side of artists. And not to mention, I've been in this business for such a long time. I'm friends with most of these people. So selfishly, it's a way I can say, I can fucking get my showbiz friends to say, yeah, I'll commit an hour to a conversation with my pal Drew. Because otherwise, it's like no one really wants to get on Zoom and have like a happy hour for the 400th time. It's like, why not just have a podcast where I can invite them on and we can chat? And the more I do it, the more it's getting its own voice. The more I'm proud of these episodes. And I think bottom line is there's a lot for theater fans and just fans of show business to take away from these stories from people and these conversations between me and somebody else they might look up to.
I agree. That's exactly why you and I are talking, because I have this podcast. I wanted to humanize the artist and For me, it's a little bit, I incorporate more of the journey because I want to know how you overcame the struggles and maintain the success.
100%.
Right? Yeah. So that to me is very important. I love the human aspect of this, and especially now with social media, and it makes it easy for us to connect to the people that oftentimes get idolized. And, but on the flip side, there's like social media is a presentation of somebody. It's their it's their idea of what they want you to know about themselves. And sometimes you have like an Amber Ardolino who's very vocal about depression and anxiety, and then you've got other people who are just like, I'm in the midst of 2020, I'm on a beach and posting bikini pictures posting my whatever it is. And I wanted to make sure that through conversations, and it sounds like you do too. And I love listening to your podcast too. There's, you know, episode 5, actually with Amber Ardolino, came out yesterday.
Yes, that's right.
As we record this. It's just fun. They're fun conversations. So everybody listening now, if you like Drew, pause, go find Now We're Talking with Drew Gasparini.
Well, better yet, don't pause. Finish this episode then go check out Now We're Talking with Drew Gasparini, for the love of God. This is a great podcast too. And I think what I really like what you're saying about the human aspect, and the thing that I agree with, what Amber does and what a lot of people do when they talk about mental illness or their struggles. I mean, mental illness is the thing that everyone kind of bullet points all the time, but it's just, let's blanket it like a struggle. That is an umbrella everybody can get under. There's not one person. You could have the shiniest career, you could have the shiniest love life and the shiniest set of parents or whatever. There is something fucked up with you. And I think that is the connective tissue. That's the adhesive that brings artists and other humans together, is you're fucked up too. See? Look at us. Look at all of us being fucked up together. It's a big yucky jacuzzi. We're all sitting in it. Let's discuss. I like that idea.
That's what, actually, I almost named this podcast is You're Fucked Up Too.
Yeah, I almost named my podcast Big Yucky Jacuzzi, so.
That has so many worse connotations.
A yucky jacuzzi.
A big yucky jacuzzi. Karate Kid.
Yeah.
To talk about something that's not a jacuzzi. So Karate Kid, before it was announced, how many years, was it years that you were attached to that before it was finally announced? Because I know so many things are like behind the closed doors.
I couldn't say anything for a year and some change, I would say. So it was like, I mean, like my family knew, of course, and like my very immediate friends, Alex Brightman and the morons, F. Michael and Andrew Kober, they all knew, but they understand that business and they understand to keep that shit close to their chest and not shout it out everywhere. Anytime I got drunk in public, I was basically telling any stranger that walked up to me. So I kind of blew it left and right. And I would do it at shows and stuff. I'd be performing on stage and I'd be like, I got some big news. And then I see my manager in the background like shaking her head ferociously. I was like, I bought a new mattress today. I'd like make up something else that wasn't the Karate Kid news. But the way that Karate Kid came about was amazing. And the day I got the job was like so crazy on levels just because of the circumstances. So if you don't, can I tell the story a little bit? Is that
yeah,
cool?
Go ahead, please. Yeah, okay.
So,
please.
So it was like 2018 and it was July, June or July. And I get an email from this producer. This producer emails me and he says, we're doing Karate Kid, the musical. And the production company is called Gorgeous Entertainment. And I looked them up and they've had like a couple shows on Broadway, but they mostly do like international big fat operas and musicals and things like that over in Asia and Japan and China and things like that. So I kind of said no, not because I didn't take the production company seriously, because I didn't take Karate Kid the musical seriously. I didn't see a world that this needed to belong. Frankly, I didn't remember the movie that well. All I remembered was like the crane kick and wax on, wax off and all that kind of shit.
Right.
And I said, you know, I don't think so. I'm not interested. So months later, maybe October, they go, hi, yo, we're still looking for a writer. And I know there were a lot of big names going in for this job. At this point, I had heard that a lot of people were going in. So I'm a little more interested because of who I'm hearing are trying to audition to get this job. And by the way, I was in no place financially or mentally to turn down any work. I really wasn't. And I was still like not sold on the idea that Karate Kid the musical should happen. What changed my mind was talking to the writer of the movie, Robert Mark Kamen, and the director, Amon Miyamoto. He's a profoundly visionary Japanese director. And they kind of told me their vision for the piece. And it was so not what I expected. And then the producer said, so we heard you talk to the guys. What do you think now? And I said, yes, what do you need? I want this. I really want this now. What do you need? They said, go rewatch the movie and find a couple moments that you think could use a song. So I found three moments that I thought could use a song. I wrote my dick off. I like, I'm not kidding. When I rewatched the movie, my brain exploded because I was like, oh my God, of course this should be a fucking musical. Everybody remembers those quotable moments, wax on, wax off. The story about this kid being lost and moving to a new place and not knowing anybody and needing protection and needing mentorship. That relationship between Miyagi and Daniel is some of the greatest cinema ever. And it belongs on stage. It's so worthy of a book, script, a play. It's so worthy of all that. So I saw these moments. I wrote these songs. I submitted them. The next day I got an email from the producer saying, we loved it. The director from Japan is going to fly out to meet you. So I have a meeting at the offices of Gorgeous Entertainment. I meet the director, who is wildly eccentric. He stood on a chair and started shouting when he was excited that I was saying things that made him happy. He asked, like, how do you see, well, what's important about the show and how do you see this story being told and this, that, and the other? So I gave my spiel and he stood up on his chair and in very broken English, he's just like, that's exactly what I'm saying. That's exactly what I'm saying. And then he sat back down and he goes, all right, so let's start storyboarding. Let's start writing this thing. And I was like, oh my God, did I just get the fucking job? Did I just get the job right here in this room? The producers look at the director and go, actually, Drew, can you come into our office real quick? They said, listen, we're still talking to other writers. So don't take him seriously yet. We are the ones in charge of hiring and firing, and it's looking very good for you. We want you to know, but we're still considering a couple other people. So my excitement got squished down to like half deflated. And I was like, okay, that's fine. Could be another no, and that's okay. We can handle no's in this business. You've gotten used to that. So about a week later, they go, we want to take you to the Palm and set up a dinner. Is that okay? And I said, yeah, of course. Oh my God. Right away, I'm like, I got the job. Why would they take me to the Palm if they're going to say, you didn't get this job? So
why didn't they even tell you you're fired?
But before I went to the Palm, I was getting drunk with Alex Brightman and F. Michael Haney. So that night we were having at Buffalo Wild Wings of all places. We were having wings and drinking beer. And I was like, I got to go to the Palm. They're like, we'll come with you. So they came and sat at the bar adjacent to where I was having this meeting with these producers. And when they finally said, you got the job, I look at them and they're like giving me silent cheers and excitement, and we were giving each other's thumbs up, and we're like, they knew that my career had changed right in that moment. I knew that my career had changed in that moment. I walked outside, I called my parents, and my mom or my dad said, wow, that's such a famous movie. And it was right then that I was like, no, I'm going to fuck this up. Like the pressure. I keep saying to people, like, imagine having a property as famous as, like, I don't know anybody who doesn't know what Karate Kid is. Even if they haven't seen the movie, everybody knows. It's like the Beatles. You might not have ever heard the Beatles, but you know who they are. This is a wildly famous title. And I've seen Broadway musicals get so fucked up by the time they get their hashtag Pretty Woman, rest in peace. But it's scary to have that much pressure on your shoulders. But the minute we started working on it, it became ours. And we're going to hang on tight to all the things people love about the movie, but we really are writing this thing that stands all on its own. And now we have all this buzz because of Cobra Kai on Netflix, and this Karate Kid universe just keeps growing and growing, and to our advantage. So I'm really, really excited. And the small last little part of this story, I'm sorry, this is so long, dude. Oh my God.
I love this story. This is amazing.
But the last little part of it is the next week I booked the Skittles commercial, the very infamous publicity stunt put on by Skittles for the Super Bowl, where instead of airing an actual commercial, they would suck away the buzz from actual Super Bowl commercials and put on a 1 hour long live musical ad for Skittles starring Michael C. Hall from Dexter as a bodega cat, by the way. That's what he was in this musical. So I get that job. That's a little side piece, but I get that job and I look at the cast list because I didn't have anything to do with the cast. They just kind of casted it before I started working on it. And Julia Macchio, I see this name, Julia Macchio. Macchio, exactly. You know, like Ralph Macchio from the Karate Kid.
Right.
And I see this name. And then the first day of rehearsal, I go, I hate to ask. I already knew the answer because she looked just like him. I was like, is your dad Ralph Macchio? And she's like, yeah, that's my dad. I go, okay, this is so weird. But like last week, I just got hired to write the score for The Karate Kid going to Broadway. And she's like, that's you? You're going to be doing that? My dad's been hearing about this project for like the last 2 years because it's been percolating for a while. So it was what a weird string of events to turn the job down, then to see the light in the job and go for it, then to get the job. And then the next job I get, one of the cast members is Ralph Macchio's fucking daughter. It was so weird.
Well, I think Michael C. Hall's maiden name is Marito. Marita?
Yeah.
Marita.
Pat Marita. That's right. Yeah. Michael C. Hall Marita. He hyphens it now.
Yes. That's awesome, though. The Skittle stunt, I watched that, and I was looking, scratching my head at what that actually was.
Yeah, we by the end product, that was. I mean, like, I feel like people who did drugs in the 60s are the only people I can relate to after that experience, because it felt like an acid dream. It felt like an absolute fucking, like a Alice in Wonderland trip that I will never fully understand. It was like 5 weeks of 18-hour days every single day to not only write, but cast, choreograph, rewrite with Will Eno, the Pulitzer Prize winning playwright. I mean, like, it's so insane. And record a cast album. We fucking recorded a cast album, not to mention all the promo ads they had to make for the musical itself. It was so much work in such a short amount of time that by the time we saw it live, the whole audience was applauding and it was like quite a big success. But I was like, what did I just do? What just happened? It was like waking up from a coma.
But it was so good though. It really was, because
I'm glad you say that.
I mean, it was treated like a real musical, and it was a real musical.
It was certainly on brand with like Skittles advertising humor. If you see any of their commercials, and like it was crazy.
Yeah, I was watching before this, watching commercials on YouTube for the show. And then I was watching people because they were allowed to record in the show. So a lot of the show is on YouTube.
Yeah, there's a couple bootlegs of it. And it's just so fucking wild. It's so wild. And if you know Will Eno's writing at all, just imagine that in the setting of a musical advertisement for Skittles. It is so strange.
Well, so we've got, of course, Karate Kid on the horizon, and let's see, Night Shift for Warner Brothers, and you've got Universal that you're doing. Like, how many different projects are you working on right now that are going to start rolling out? And I guess in true Alex Timbers form, you're probably going to have like your Beetlejuice and your Moulin Rouge hit Broadway in the same season, right?
That kind of shit's way out of my control. Like, for instance, it's kind of a funny story. It's a project I've been working on with Alex Brightman since 2014. Here we are in 2021, right? So I think Karate Kid is going to make its way to Broadway pretty soon. We have some developmental news for It's Kind of a Funny Story that we were going to announce right before this pandemic. I still can't say what it is. It's one of those things, unfortunately. But if the timing goes right, we're going to have some sort of regional or off-Broadway production of It's Kind of a Funny Story close to around the same time, I would imagine. So I do think that might be the case where it looks like I'm being pulled in separate directions. But I've been writing both those shows simultaneously for the last number of years. So that's just how it goes. And there's a few. I mean, I think I'm in the middle of writing 6 musicals right now.
Jeez.
Yeah, that's not even on the list of things you just mentioned. So.
I know. I was going to say like, well, what's next and what can we hear? But I know you can't say, and it doesn't matter.
It's not going to matter until it matters. And you know, then, I always, the best testing ground for any show that I'm writing is just showcasing a song or two from those shows at my next whatever concert, 54 Below or Lincoln Center or wherever I'm going to be playing. That's where I like to be like, here's a little taste of what's to come. So you can find literally over 200 songs, original ideas and songs on YouTube of it's like a combination of all the shows I've been working on and are continuing to work on.
So I hope that after all this hits Broadway, your next step will be shifting into your animated stuff. I think now especially that, you know, Cobra Kai's on Netflix. Netflix is recording Broadway shows. I mean, the stars are starting to align in my mind for you to easily have this trajectory of Netflix is going to step in. And if they haven't already, and it's been like, hey, we're just going to record, Karate Kid and just put it out there next to Cobra Kai. You know what I mean?
I wouldn't hate that. I think that'd be a really fun and awesome marketing tool for our producers and for Netflix. So call my agent, Netflix.
And you've got Over the Moon, which stars a bunch, which animated show, which stars a bunch of Broadway people on Disney Plus, right? And of course, Disney's involved with Hamilton. So I think I'm glad I know you now, so that when you're super famous, that I can say like, remember that episode we had, Drew?
Don't forget, I'll never be more famous than like Ben Harper. I just want to stay somewhere.
That's where you'll stop. You'll stop at Ben Harper.
And I'll still be a host of a podcast, I would assume. So even while if you're a host of a podcast, you really can't be all that famous. You're a host of a podcast, right? You're behind. You know, no one's looking at us. People are just listening to us. So
you got the good looks for a podcast. I agree with that.
That's what my mom says too. You got the face for podcasting. That's right.
All right. Well, let's wrap up the episode here with the 3 standard closing questions I ask everybody. The first one simply is, what motivates you?
What motivates me is whoever is new, I get motivated because you get tired so easily writing and writing and writing, and you're stuck in a tunnel with your own shit all day. I love getting like reinvigorated by these young people doing their thing. Like the Ratatouille thing, the experience of seeing all that collaboration, I was like, oh my God, that's right. Collaboration's awesome. I can't wait to work with this guy again. And then I'll email that person and we'll get started on something. So that the excitement of new generations of artists excite me.
And what advice would you give to your younger self and younger people listening out, starting out down a similar path? And I know you sort of answered this earlier.
Sure. I would say that to my younger self, your first no is going to be the first of 10 trillion endless amounts of no's. And it's not a blow to who you are as a person. It's just a wake-up call that you need to be open to adjusting. You need to be open to growing. It's not about changing necessarily to fit some mold, but always be able to grow along with the system that you're joining.
And last question, if you could only see one show for the rest of your life, but you can see it as many times as you want, what would you see?
Chorus Line.
Why?
There's a lot of heart, there's a lot of humor, and the music is so painfully good. I don't think in all the years that I've been obsessed with that musical, I have never gotten tired of that score. I don't see myself ever getting tired of that score. And I don't know. So many things are these personal stories. I just love personal stories. I feel like that musical does what we're trying to do with these podcasts, which is humanize the artist. And I will always be an appreciator of that.
Well, I'm going to introduce you to Donna McKechnie. She can be a guest on your podcast.
That would be dope. Yes.
Yeah.
Jumbo, hell yeah.
All right. We'll make that happen.
Cool.
All right. Where can we find you online and buy your sheet music and all of the Drew things?
You can go to thedrewgasparini.com. You can find my sheet music on Music Notes or newmusicaltheater.com. You can follow me on social medias at Drew Gasparini on Twitter and Instagram. But if you want to see what I'm doing on TikTok, go to at thedrewgasparini and I'll be goofing around there as well. And God, you know, when this world opens back up all the way, look out for more shows because I'm going to be relentless in my live performance.
I hope so. And I can't wait to hear what you've got coming. You can get more of me at thetheaterpodcast.com. I'm on Instagram and Twitter at theater_podcast. Please leave a rating, leave a review. This has been edited by Matthew Hendershot, music by Jukebox the Ghost, and conversation by Drew Gasparini.
He's yes.
doing the fist pump.
Fist pump.
Take a deep breath, make the world a little colorful.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.